your upcoming speaker. We're being joined by Earl Liverman, who retired in 2015 with more than 25 years of experience as an on-scene coordinator, or OSC, and remedial project manager, or RPM, for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in Region 10. Prior to the EPA, Earl spent about 10 years involved with state environmental management and natural resources activities. And Earl has a slew of degrees, including a Bachelor of Science in Forest and Military Science from Oregon State, a Master of Public Administration from the University of Oklahoma, a Master of Science degree from the State University of New York, and Syracuse University. And he also has a doctorate from the University of Puget Sound School of Law. I'm going to pull up Earl's material and then again just remind everybody that you should be here for this course, which will provide OSCs and RPMs with an overview of the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, and Section 7 requirements under EPA's emergency response and removal programs. And then we'll also later on then get into an overview of the National Historic Preservation Act, or NHPA, and Section 106 requirements under EPA's emergency response and removal program. So with that, Earl, I'm going to go ahead and let you kick things off today whenever you're ready to begin.
Okay, and I trust everyone can hear me.
We can.
And welcome. I likewise am getting over summer cold, so please bear with me and we'll go from there. All right, the intent of this, the next 45 minutes or an hour or so that we spend together, is to provide a broad overview of the Endangered Species Act and what's referred to as Section 7 requirements under EPA's Emergency Response and Removal Program. Shorthand, it's just Section 7. And in particular, I hope to focus on what the responsibilities are of OSCs and RPM to consider the effects of those actions that they may be involved with on listed species and their habitat. And I'd like to emphasize the notion of habitat. Oftentimes that's something that's overlooked, but it's critical with respect to understanding how the act may come into play at your sites. The purpose of the act is to provide a means for conserving the ecosystems upon which endangered and threatened species depend, and a program for the conservation of those species. Section 7 of the act itself outlines those procedures for federal interagency cooperation to conserve federally listed species and those critical habitats. So we're very fortunate to have a variety of procedures in place that are acknowledged by the different agencies involved, which frankly provides EPA and other federal agencies that have been delegated authorities pursuant to Executive Order 12580 to respond to releases of hazardous substances or discharges of oil. So again, thinking in terms of Section 7 consultation, Section 7A1 directs federal agencies to utilize their authorities in furtherance of the purposes of the ESA by carrying out programs for the conservation of species listed pursuant to the Endangered Species Act. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we progress through the slides. Also, Section 7A2 directs federal agencies to ensure that any action that they authorize, fund, or carry out is not likely to jeopardize the continued existence of listed species. It's very important to key in on the phrase authorize, fund, or carry, and carry out. And similarly, we'll talk about that here in a short while. In fulfilling the Section 7 requirements, there's two agencies that have been charged with the implementation of the Endangered Species Act. It's the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, or the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the regulations regarding the Endangered Species Act are found at 50 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 402. And I would encourage everyone to spend the time just familiarizing themselves because I have found over the course of many, many years as an OSC and as an RPM, there are two statutes that you can plan on encountering at some point in time. And one, of course, is the Endangered Species Act, and the other is the National Historic Preservation Act, which we'll talk about on the following presentation once we're through with Section 7. Okay, there's a variety of terms that everyone should have some working knowledge of if they're going to work within the Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act. And beginning right at the start of things is, what is an endangered species? And it's any species which is endangered throughout all or a significant portion of its range. Very, very important. It could apply to animals or plants. It's not attached to a particular taxonomic. Then you have threatened species, and those are any species which is likely to become an endangered species within the foreseeable future. So hence you now understand where the acronym TNE may come from, which is threatened and endangered. Then you have the critical habitat, and that's something that more often than not is overlooked. And that is, you know, that habitat that is essential for the conservation and management of listed species. Another thing to keep in mind as you're considering these definitions is to understand and appreciate the role of the resource managers both within both services, the Fish and Wildlife Service as well as National Marine Fisheries. And that is, they are resource managers. Their day-to-day job is to oversee implementation of these acts. And the only time that resource managers are pulled into the world of OSCs, on-scene coordinators, or RPM's remedial project managers is incidental to the various projects that they're involved with. And in many instances as an OSC, that includes removal actions, whether it be emergency actions, time critical and non-time critical. And the way in which they will interact with you is greatly influenced by the type of action that they do so, particularly with respect to the removal program. For the remedial program, it's very different with respect to ARARs, and at the end of the day, I think you'll realize that on that continuum of ARARs, if you're dealing with a non-time critical action, which are those actions that take 6 months or more to plan for, or a remedial project of some sort, that the opportunity to work with the services and prompt ways that take into consideration the urgency of what you're dealing with changes considerably. And we'll talk some more about that as we go over the different types of consultation that can occur. And then we have what is referred to as harm. And generally speaking, from my rather simplistic perspective, harm is anything that could cause an adverse effect, if you will, on wildlife. It's very broad, and here in a moment we're going to look at a slide that gives you a sense of that continuum of effect. Okay, the effects of the action, there's potentially four. Direct effects are those that are caused by the action and occur along with the action itself. It might be the destruction of habitat. For example, if you're working in a small stream, there may be the bed and banks that are affected. It could include standing timber. If you're potentially involved with a mine site, you have to remove timber in order to address the underlying contaminant problem. Those are examples of indirect effects, of direct effects. Indirect effects could be something that occur later on in time. Again, perhaps it's incidental to the cleanup of the bed and banks of an impacted stream. Maybe it's large areas of ground that have been disturbed, incidental to your cleanup and the like. May effect or no effect are those accounts which are simply discountable or insignificant, or could be completely beneficial, such as the restoration of habitat incidental to the stabilization of disturbed areas. And then there are adverse effects, which are those that you want to avoid, but that can otherwise be measured, detected, or evaluated in some manner. Now, the graph or the image that you see here, I've always found to be very telling. And so you can see a definition of effect. It's what you have when you have exposure plus response. But what's particularly important about the image that you see is to your left, an effect could be something as simple as startle, alarm, or avoidance. So let's say, for example, you might have a small discharge of oil that occurred along the banks of a stream. And the only readily discernible impact that you can see is maybe a small sheen that's emanating out of the riprap into the stream. Well, the effect on the organisms that inhabit the stream could be nothing more than avoidance. In other words, fish that are traveling up one side of the bank simply move to the other. But that is nevertheless an effect. Maybe there's benthic organisms that move out of the riprap out into the main channel of the stream. Just the movement alone to avoid the impact is an example of effect. And then you move across to the far right side, and depth could be a direct effect of your cleanup actions. If, for example, you're in the field and you're having to excavate contaminated areas, and perhaps there's nesting birds and trees are on the ground that you're unaware of, or maybe there's reptiles or something such as that. So this just gives you, I hope, a depiction as to what that spectrum could be with respect to what is an effect. Then some of the other words you should keep in mind is take. It's what you always want to avoid, whether it means to harass, harm, pursue, hunt, shoot, and the like. Then you have harass, an intentional or negligent act, which creates the likelihood of injuring wildlife. And here in a moment, we're going to talk about the broad spectrum of the type of animals that could come into play. Harm, again, it's very broad. And you saw in the preceding slide an example of what that harm might be across the continuum of severity. All very important concepts to keep in mind, because if and when you should ever have to deal with the services, which again are Fish and Wildlife and National Marine Fisheries, these are words that they're going to use and that you should likewise use as you begin to assess and evaluate the potential impacts your project might have with respect to Section 7 issues. Then you have some other terms, incidental take, which is very important, biological assessment, which if you should all have some work and familiarity with, even at the ER phase or emergency response phase, there is an assessment or an evaluation, if you will, that occurs on a very fast track. If you're doing a time-critical or a non-time-critical removal action, the biological assessment is critical in the description of your acts, and it's also the basis on which the service will issue either a concurrence letter or a biological opinion with respect to your overall activities. All right, now, this slide is intended to give you a sense as to the many plants and animals that are out there. So, for example, my recent check of listed animals is approaching 1,500, and you see that they include both invertebrates as well as vertebrates. And I also hope you sense that the vast majority of those creatures are not typically the warm fuzzies that you might think of. For example, they're not Selkirk caribou with respect to the vertebrates. Rather, you could have amphibians, a wide variety of birds, along with fishes and reptiles. On the flip side, with invertebrates, you could have spiders, clams, crustaceans, insects, snails. And then you move over across the plants, of which there are about 950 or so that are listed, and you see such things as flowering plants and non-flowering plants. So the intent of this slide is just to convey to you the enormity of the list of potential threatened and endangered species that you might have associated with your sites. As well as the critical habitat. And these are all things that you should keep in mind as you progress through the different activities that you're involved with. Okay, an action. You'll recall early on that we referred to particular sections of the Endangered Species Act, and in particular, that section that requires agencies to consider acts, which was 7A2. So some examples of acts are the promulgation of regulations, and that might be pretty conspicuous. Not so much so for EPA, but for other land management agencies such as the Bureau of Land Management, the United States Forest Service, perhaps the National Park Service. There may be the granting of licenses, leases, easements, permits, and the like. But then where EPA comes into play, more than likely what an action is defined as is you know, an act that directly or indirectly causes modifications to the land, water, or air. In other words, cleanup activities, irrespective if they be removal in nature or remedial in nature. So arguably, EPA's activities clearly fall into the realm of this definition, and perhaps maybe to a lesser or greater extent with respect to the grants that might otherwise be provided by EPA to states, whether they be clean air grants or clean water grants, brownfield or whatever. This is just something to keep in mind, but generally speaking, thinking in terms of CERCLA, cleanup activities would fall well within the parameters of what is considered to be an action. Okay, and so here's a couple of pictures of an example of a mine site located up in north central Idaho. This is the Conjecture Mine and Mill site. Off to your left, you can see the site before any cleanup activities occurred. The threatened and endangered species that were associated with this particular site were bull trout, along with other mammals. You can see that the stream was heavily impacted by mine waste materials, to include waste rocks, so the solid phase of contaminants, if you will, as well as the dissolved phase, the other constituents that were part of the contaminants of concern. The slide, and you can see the habitat as well, arguably within the riparian corridor, but for a few small shrubs, principally willow and alder, there was no habitat per se that was present. The slide to the right shows the cleanup activities that occurred at the site, and those activities included not only the restoration of the bed and banks of the stream, or the stabilization, if you will, to restore the the hydraulic characterization or characteristics of the stream, but also in-stream habitat, grade control structures in the adjoining riparian corridor. But then also, as you move out of that, the removal of several feet of contaminated materials and the subsequent stabilization of that. So this is a very common depiction of those types of activities that you might find at remote mine sites in North Idaho and elsewhere throughout the country. Okay, consultation. There are three types of consultation, and whenever a federal agency must consult with the services on one of these types of consultations, there is a very well-written and complete consultation handbook that's shown off to the right. My experience has been that this is relatively easy to follow and straightforward, particularly from the perspective of emergency response actions. But this is laid out. The services are very, very familiar with the requirements, and I've always had, there's been no surprises, particularly when you think in terms of building a relationship with other federal agencies in the field and how you might interact and work with each other and build upon those relationships to do the things that you have to do. So let's begin with emergency consultation. Section 7 regulations recognize that an emergency may require expedited consultation. In fact, within the consultation handbook, Chapter 8 is specifically devoted to emergency consultations, and it's a very thorough and complete presentation. It's important to note that the emergency consultation process enables both agencies, EPA as well as Fish and Wildlife or National Marine Fisheries, to move through this in a very prompt manner, and to do so without impeding the actions of EPA. In other words, the service will not adhere to otherwise strict administrative requirements associated with the Endangered Species Act status as an ARAR, but rather they have regulations in place that allow things to move very quickly. And this is an example. The image shows you a derailment, and this is clearly an example of an emergency action and would trigger the emergency consultation procedures that an EPA OSC or an OSC from another federal agency might follow if they were dealing with non-time critical removal actions. So what happens here is that pursuant to the NCP, OSCs have the responsibility to notify natural resource trustees if in the event or upon the discovery of or notification of an incident. And so EPA or the other federal agencies will get in contact with their regional offices or persons who are otherwise designated as a point of contact for the notification of an incident. During that initial phone call, the OSC will do their best to identify the approximate location of where the incident occurred, some sense as to the nature and the gravity of the incident, and additional information, whether it's an ongoing release, types of contaminants of concern, the magnitude and the like. And then based upon that conversation, perhaps with the initial contact or a subsequent contact in Fish and Wildlife or National Marine Fisheries, those resource managers will look at their lists and they will make a determination as to whether or not there are any threatened or endangered species, whether or not there's critical habitat, whether or not there might be species proposed for listing and the like. So the initial contact is very, very important. If threatened and endangered species are present and or critical habitat is present, then they will also offer advice on measures that would be appropriate for minimizing the effects of the emergency response on those species or their critical habitat. And that's very important. You may also find that in order to address that more directly or more thoroughly, you would want to bring that resource manager into incident command or unified command if you have it set up and there's an opportunity for them to engage and become a part of activities. On the other hand, the type of advice and consultation that may occur might do so over the phone, depending upon what you've described the incident to be. Having once made that contact and identified the presence of species or habitat, there will be an occasional back and forth wherein the OSC stays in contact with the service and continues to provide updates, and as appropriate, the service will recommend additional procedures or protocols that could be followed so as to minimize the impact. The most important part of this slide is the second bullet item, and that is that neither service will stop or delay the emergency response because of the notification of a release or discharge. And Chapter 8 in the consultation handbook is very, very clear about this, and both services recognize this. Once the emergency is over, there will then be the paperwork, and therein will be a discussion as to whether or not there was any adverse impacts that occurred, and hopefully not, as a result of the back and forth that EPA, along with the services, have engaged in. However, if there is an adverse impact to listed species or critical habitat, you may very well find yourself engaged with formal consultation. So by way of going back over this, the flow chart shows it. A federal action occurs, i.e. a response, and the EPA, through any number of mechanisms, maybe the phone duty officer or a geographic OSC or someone, will initiate contact with the service. Oftentimes, regions will have designated individuals who in turn will relay the information down to the Fish and Wildlife or National Marine Fisheries. Based upon that initial consultation, if it's determined that there are no listed species or critical habitat, then that completes consultation. However, if there are, then there is a period of ongoing evaluation during which there's a back and forth between EPA and the services, and EPA will receive proposals from the services to minimize the impact and the like. And then at some point in time, the emergency will be over. And at that point, either there were no adverse impacts, and that's the completion of consultation, or there were adverse impacts, and then that'll be the beginning of formal consultation. Now, oftentimes, these provisions are laid out in the various area contingency plans. So if you were to refer to your area contingency plan, as often as not, you will find this as an annex that you can go to, or you can simply get a hold of the consultation handbook. So that's emergency response. Relatively straightforward, has always worked well for me. It's proved to be particularly beneficial to engage this process built on a long-standing working relationship with your counterparts in the field, so that at least when you have that conversation, it's not the first meeting, but rather it's one of a series of meetings that have provided a longstanding and viable working relationship. I've also found that on the periphery of emergency response actions that maybe consultation need not be more complicated than a phone call. If you're dealing with an extraordinarily small site, maybe a site that's measured only 100 feet by 100 feet, and you're not involved with an emergency response action, nor do you want to engage in more formal, informal consultation, if you will, then you might have the opportunity to get in contact with your local field office and speak with a staff biologist, describe for them the location of your cleanup site, the activity that you're contemplating, what the surrounding environment might look like, and you might very well at that point be able to conclude that there will be no impact on listed species or critical habitat, and he or she would be more than happy to send you an email. So there's other examples beyond these three types of consultation that are available to you, particularly if you have a working relationship already in place. Okay, informal consultation is that what you would likely encounter were you to be doing either a time-critical or a non-time-critical response action. And generally what this is a process that you will go through to determine whether or not there are T&E, or critical habitat, found within your project area. Generally, how it begins is that you will put together a letter, either as an OSC or perhaps an RPM, and you will send it to your local field office or regional office, service field or regional office. And therein, you will attach a map that shows your approximate site boundaries, and you will describe the work that you're contemplating performing on site. You'll send that off to the service, and soon thereafter, you will receive a letter that says there are either no threatened or endangered species or critical habitat, or you will receive a list that is typically representative of the county as a whole within which you're proposing the work. I've never received a reply that has focused simply on the site boundaries as I envisioned them, but rather it'll be a much larger geographic area, which takes into consideration the movement of critters, if you will, throughout their habitat. As noted on the third bullet, if the service provides a negative response, then you're done. You simply document their decision, and you make sure that it goes either into the administrative record or the site file, whichever is appropriate. On the other hand, if the services have determined that there are listed species present, then you're more than likely going to have to prepare what is referred to as a biological opinion. In those instances, when I've done that, that's been done by START, our technical consultants, engineering scientific consultants, and a biologist or an ecologist will go out into the field, and they will perform a survey and of the area. They will identify the area in great detail, indicate whether or not any threatened species, listed species, are present or habitat, and then they will go on to make a determination as to what, if any, impact your proposal will have. In essence, my experience with this has been to work closely with the service up front. Get them out into the field if you can, if necessary, put in place an interagency agreement with the service so that if you wanted to engage them early on and have them assist you with the preparation of field sampling plans, the identification of media to be sampled, the location of sampling activities, the list of analytes to look at, that's great because you're getting in front of this issue now of putting together your biological assessment. Moreover, you maintain close coordination with the services throughout this entire process, because what will happen is that at some point after you've completed your action memorandum, the biological assessment will be formally submitted to the services for review and comment. My experience has been is that the services will look at your action memorandum and supporting documentation, and in particular the BMPs, or best management practices, that you've included as part of your cleanup action so as to mitigate the adverse effects to the environment, will be taken by the services and included in their response to you and their no effect determination that is hopefully given to you in as a concurrence letter. So in other words, develop and maintain that long-standing relationship, because as you get closer and closer to the end, i.e. completion of your action memorandum, there are no surprises to the services. They know what's coming. They've had a chance to work with you in the development of that document, such that when they do issue the concurrence letter for informal consultation, there are no surprises and it moves quickly. On the other hand, formal consultation is a very challenge in and of itself. I've never had to do this. Suffice to say, it could have a profound impact on your project schedule, your project costs, and perhaps even the scope. And please keep in mind that although ARARs, the compliance with ARARs provides some flexibility as you get further along that continuum in the direction of non-time critical and the like, you frankly lose the opportunity to minimize, if you will, the administrative requirements that are associated with ARARs for CERCLA activities. And of course, ARARs as a concept does not at all apply to oil spill or OPA responses. And it's a much more lengthy and time-consuming process. It concludes with a formal opinion issued, biological opinion issued by the services. Okay, so in a nutshell, this is what the consultation process looks like. First of all, you make a determination yourself initially as to whether or not you might have listed species or critical habitat. For example, if you're working in a highly built-up urban area, you do not necessarily need to get in contact with one of the services. That's up to you as an OSC or an RPM to decide. However, if you think you might have listed species or critical habitat, that's when you'll get in touch with the services. And oftentimes, that first step as to whether or not you should even go further will occur with notification as you reach out and share information. If there is no effect, then that's the end of consultation. You just document that to the best of your abilities and move on. On the other hand, if there is a may effect, you develop a biological opinion. And that scope depends largely on your site and the issues that you're dealing with. And I said biological opinion, I meant biological assessment. Out of that assessment, there'll either be a determination of not likely to adversely affect or likely to adversely affect. Hopefully it's not likely to adversely affect. The service concurs because you've done your upfront and sustained coordination with the service, and then that ends informal consultation. On the other hand, if the service does not concur, then you've not done your upfront work. And remember that when you ask for the concurrence of the service, it's after the decision document is signed, so it could have a profound effect on the removal program. If the service doesn't concur, then you launch in the formal consultation. On the other hand, if out of that biological assessment, the determination to be made by EPA is that it's likely to adversely affect, then you have to go into formal consultation. So what I've provided for you is a very high-level overview. It's not intended to make you an expert in any way, shape, or form. Rather, it's simply intended to give you a familiarity with a particular statute that is very common to be encountered at those sites found, particularly in west of the Mississippi, or those sites that are not necessarily urban in character but are more rural in their nature. Emergency consultation is there if you have to move very quickly. And there are regulations in place, guidance documents, and the services know well that they're not there to impede or otherwise hinder the response, but rather are there to assist it to the best of their abilities and then to deal with paperwork matters after the fact. Informal consultation is there. It's much more of a streamlined process, particularly when you deal with it early on, and it helps you decide whether or not formal consultation is needed. And then formal consultation is that process if, based upon your action or your informal consultation activities, you conclude that your actions may adversely affect listed species, then you're engaged with the formal consultation process, which again, it's lengthy, it's time-consuming, and could have a significant overall impact on project schedules, costs, scope, and the like. And then I've always found that early coordination is the key to your overall planning activities, as well as interagency collaboration on the document itself. Again, if you can get a hold of someone to come and spend time with you for a few hours or maybe a day, and they can do so within their existing funding mechanisms, that's great. However, if you wanted to engage them in a more detailed and time-consuming way, if you will, there are funding mechanisms that are available, such as interagency agreements, where you might be able to set aside a nominal amount of money that they could draw on to support their efforts to assist you, not in the context of their role as a resource manager per se in the review of documents, but more in a collaborative activity to assist you, to exchange information and the like. And the quick resolution of issues are all trademarks of successful consultations and engagement with the services. Okay, so at that point, I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Okay, just a quick reminder, if you haven't submitted your questions into the Q&A window, you can do so at any time by typing them into the empty space in the bottom right corner of your screen. I do have a few questions that have come in already, so I'll start with those. The first question asks, what if a species is just proposed to the endangered species list? Do you need to go through the same process as you would if the species is officially listed?
Well, that's a heck of a question. And I'm not sure, I don't have a direct answer for that, other than to say it's an example of the type of activity that you would want to engage one of the services with to understand what the requirements might be incidental to a proposed species as opposed to one that's listed. And so that would be my answer. Get in touch with the service, have that conversation with them, weigh their conversation in the context of what your proposed activities are and the like, and then move on from there.
Okay. We have another attendee who would like to know, where can I find the consultation handbook? I believe that was the 1998 one. You had a screenshot of the cover of the consultation handbook.
Yes, I would go to the website fws.gov, And once on that site, you should be able to find and download the consultation handbook.
Okay, and there have been any updates to it? The 1998 edition is the most recent one?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And I don't know if this is an easy-to-answer question or not, but somebody would like to know, does EPA pay for the consultations in any way?
Well, yes, except in those instances when the service incurs costs or commits resources to the review of documents that fall within its day-to-day charter, so to speak. So, for example, if you were to ask a service representative to come out on site, not in their role as a resource manager who implements a particular statute on a daily basis, but rather to come out, to come onto your project and assist you with project activities such as the development of a field sampling plan, then the expectation would be that you would pay for that through some funding mechanism. That wouldn't be the case if it were a few hours here or there. So you would pay for that. But when you engage the service pursuant to their resource manager role, then no, you would not pay them to review your biological opinion or to prepare the concurrence letter or the likes.
Okay. Another attendee has asked, do FWS and NOAA use the same consultation handbook?
Say again? I'm sorry.
So they would like to know if do FWS and NOAA, N-O-A-A, use the same consultation handbook?
Yes, but please keep in mind that there are subtle differences between the two agencies that reflect different internal policies and guidances. But as far as using that consultation handbook that I've mentioned, it's my understanding that both agencies rely on that as the parent document, if you will.
Okay, excellent. And then we did have another question that came in, but it looked like you answered it. I'm just going to read it out loud for the benefit of anyone else who might have also had a similar question. Does the definition of endangered species include plant life as well? I know you touched on this, but could you just reinforce, are plants included?
Yes. Endangered species includes plants, in particular flowering and non-flowering plants are the two broad taxonomic categories. And so that includes such things as the non-flowering would be conifers, ferns, lichen, and the like, and of course all flowering plants. And my last check on that is that there's about 945 or so different threatened and endangered plant species that are listed.
Okay, excellent. Well, I don't see any other additional questions in the queue, so I think we can go ahead and close out this portion of the Q&A session, but I just want to remind the audience that we will continue on with additional breaks for Q&A, so you can continue to send in those questions and comments using the Q&A window at any time. And at this point, did you want to take a small break in the webinar, Earl?
Yes, I think 5 minutes would be a good idea.
Okay, excellent. So what we are going to do is we're going to take a short 5-minute break on the webinar. I'm going to pull up a quick timer here on the screen, and I just wanted to let everybody know, again, we're going to pause here for approximately 5 minutes. You're going to hear silence on the line during that break. You can remain connected, and then again, when the timer counts down, we'll carry on with the webinar. But feel free to step away, check your email, do what you need to do, and we will resume the live broadcast with the second portion of today's webinar in just under 5 minutes here, just before 2 p.m. Eastern.
Jean?
Yes, Earl.
Are you going to pull up the next presentation? Because right now I'm looking at questions.
Yeah, it will appear in the back.
Okay. All right, got it. Well, so how did you think that went? I think I could have done better, but...
I think you did great, Earl. Don't worry.
Well, thank you. You're very kind, but... Well, we'll see.
And Daryl, just so you know, the attendees are typing in that you did a good job. So,
oh,
don't worry.
Thank you. Well, you know, you never know about these things. Sometimes it flows well, sometimes it doesn't.
Okay, it looks like we have come to the end of our 5-minute break. So I wanted to remind the live audience, again, we're going to go ahead and resume with the live broadcast. And let me check, Earl, can you see your next slide that'll cover the NHPA?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. And so again, just one quick reminder for the remote audience, we are coming back from our 5-minute break. We'll resume with the webinar with our next section. If you have questions or comments, you can submit them into the Q&A window at any time. And again, we'll take another break for Q&A with Earl here in just a moment. But with no further delay, Earl, let me go ahead and turn things back to you to carry on with the broadcast.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. The picture that you see on the first slide is of the Avery Landing Site, which is a former railroad maintenance and refueling facility that is located in North Idaho. We will refer back to this image further on in the presentation, and I would encourage you to note the turntable that's in the center of the slide, and along beyond that turntable, you will see a number of rails that are leading into the various maintenance bays, and we'll talk about that. Okay, the intent of this course is to similarly provide an overview of the National Historic Preservation Act and its 106 requirements. In a nutshell, following World War II, there were massive government-sponsored construction projects, such as the interstate highway system and urban renewal in older cities. And as a result of those efforts, it was estimated that 25% or more of the nation's finest historic sites were lost. Well, in response to the growing public concerns about this loss of history, Congress passed the National Historic Preservation Act in 1966. And what the law did is it established a national policy for the protection of important historic buildings and archaeological sites and outlined responsibilities for federal and state governments to preserve the nation's heritage. And I hope that as a result of this presentation that you walk away with a better appreciation as to what those types of historical buildings and archaeological sites might actually be. I think you'll be surprised as we move along here. Okay, as I mentioned, it was passed in 1966, which is to say anything that happened approximately 50 years prior would fall under the purview of this site. In a nutshell, before any undertaking associated with a federal agency, you must first determine whether any of the National Historic Preservation Act Section 106 requirements apply to your project. In particular, 106 requires federal agencies to take into account the effects of their undertakings on historic properties that are listed in or eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. Additionally, 106 spells out a requirement to give the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation an opportunity to comment on such undertakings. And the ACHP is at the national level. It's council, that federal entity whose job it is to promote the preservation, enhancement, and productive use of the nation's historic resources. Okay, I'm not... Jean?
Yep, I'm here.
Jean, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me, Earl?
Yes, I'm not able to advance to the next slide. Do you see it?
I do. I can see all the slides. Earl, you may just have a temporary lack there in your internet connection. What is the current slide that you are reading right now?
Okay, the next slide is slide 4, and it says federal agency responsibilities.
Okay, and there's one, it's under NHPA that has an illustration with the rocks or the boulders, and that's up on the screen right now. Okay, so that's up on the screen right now.
Okay, well, I don't see it, so we'll just go as discussed as the contingency.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, this image is an example of a site that has particular religious or cultural significance. So this sort of breaks the mold as to what you may traditionally think of when you think of historic sites. So federal agencies are responsible for initiating 106 consultation. And what's also unique about the National Historic Preservation Act is that that's an act that's delegated to the states. So as you encounter this act, you more than likely will do so through a state historic preservation officer or a tribal historic preservation officer if your activities involve a property on a reservation or perhaps fall within the usual and customary uses of land by Native Americans and the like. And then there's also the Native Hawaiian Organization, or NHOs, that might come into play. The important thing here to note is that it's a delegated program, and each state is different as to how they handle this. So, for example, the state of Washington has the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation. So in order for you to find out who your SHPO is, you would have to, in all likelihood, go into the state capitol directory of offices and put in a keyword SHPO or State Historic Preservation Officer, and from that effort, you should be able then to find out who your state SHPO is. Okay, moving on to the next slide that's labeled Federal Agency Responsibilities under NHPA. Now, there's a couple of unique features of the NHPA, and that is that there is no explicit obligation to actually avoid or minimize adverse effects. While Section 106 review encourages, it does not mandate preservation, particularly given that in some instances there is absolutely no way for a project to proceed without harming historic properties. A mine site is a classic example where you actually have structures and features associated with the site that you have to clean up that are oftentimes embedded in the various the contaminated materials that you're trying to remove. The regulations for 106 are found in 36 CFR Part 800, and again, it's a process that's laid out that agencies are encouraged to follow so as to develop and evaluate ways to minimize or otherwise mitigate any adverse effects. Moreover, if the 106 requirements are applicable to your project, you should try to meet those requirements before and possibly during construction activities. I've had instances where I've sought to meet those activities during construction and after the fact. And one of the greater challenges that I've had to address, and we'll talk about that some more later on, is that 99 out of 100 times the SHPO likely is not familiar with CERCLA, and in particular CERCLA's provisions with respect to ARARs as to what OSCs or RPMs have to do to comply with the 106 requirements. Can please go to the next slide labeled What is an Undertaking? Okay, an undertaking somewhat similar to Section 7 means any project, activity, or program funded in whole or in part under the direct or indirect jurisdiction of a federal agency. And I've listed some examples. In essence, what you're looking for is that federal nexus, if you will, some connection between the Fed and an activity. And by the way, 106 applies only to the federal government, not to the state or private parties. To the extent that they might be covered by some type of activity, it would be at the state level. So if you're providing oversight of a cleanup activity carried out or on behalf of, if there's a nexus with respect to federal assistance, if there's a nexus requiring a federal permit, license, or approval, and the like. And the picture that you see on the right-hand side is cleanup activity that occurred at the Avery landing site a number of years ago. And in this instance, I had to comply with the 106 activity, the 106 requirements because I met the definition of an undertaking. Could we go to the next slide, please, labeled What are historic properties? The intent of these two images, again, are to give you a better appreciation as to what potentially historic properties are. It may very well be the structure that you see off to the right, which is nothing more than a historic set of grazing structures that may have been used for the grazing of cattle and sheep at higher elevations in the West many, many decades ago. And it's important to note that the definition includes artifacts, records, or remains. In this instance, you can see a pick that actually several there and other items that are commonly found at historic sites, irrespective of whether it be a mine site, it could be a homestead cabin, and the like. The point being is that the definition of and the eligibility for the National Register of Historic Places is extraordinarily broad. Next slide, please. This just illustrates that concept earlier. Recall the first slide I mentioned, the Avery landing site, the turntable and the rails embedded in concrete. The image to your left are those rail lines that engines or cars needing repairs would roll along to get into the maintenance bay. The image on the right is the outer edge of the turntable. So what you're seeing is nothing more than concrete evident on the ground surface. Those are were the types of activities or features that we had to look at as we worked through the Section 106 consultation process. Next slide, please, labeled "What is the Register of Historic Places?" In other words, it's the nation's list of properties recognized for their significance in American history. The image that you see to the right is what's referred to as a fish wheel. It's very common throughout Alaska and elsewhere in the Canadian provinces. And what this is a structure whereby fish, salmon, as they were migrating upstream, would be funneled into the structure. They would become trapped, and they would be captured. And the wheel would operate in such a manner that the fish would be spun up and dumped into a basket. Very common. The criteria for evaluating eligibility is based on significance, age, and integrity. Significance is that property, if you will, that's associated with events, activities, or developments that were important in the past. It could be with the lives of people who were historically important. It could be associated with distinctive architectural history, landscape history, or engineering achievements. It might be something that has the potential to yield important information through archaeological investigation. The point being that significance as a criteria is very broad. Age, it's generally is in order for a property to be old enough to be considered historic, it's got to be at least 50 years old. And going all the way back to the enactment of the statute itself, so you're looking at the early 1900s as a trigger for 50 years, about 1916. So that old or older, and integrity refers to the ability of the property, if you will, to convey its significance based on location, design, materials, workmanship, feeling, just how you feel about it, and the association with other issues of historical significance. Next slide, please, labeled "What is an adverse effect?" Okay, the image that you see to the right is associated with a mine site that we'll talk about later on. It proved to be very contentious, and that's the Josephine site. This was a site that any and all features were grossly contaminated with historical mine waste, tailings, waste rock, and the like. And incidental to that cleanup of the site, we caused an adverse effect on features that would otherwise be considered to be of historical value. And that might include the pipes that you see, the long linear objects that could have provided insight to the various on-site mining and milling activities. There's an old car body and the like. And my experience has been that when you put an archaeologist out on a site like this, it's like a kid on Christmas morning. He or she, it's amazing to watch them work, and the things that you would otherwise completely ignore or otherwise just glance at it passing. And that's one of the requirements of the process we'll talk about later on. But at any rate, you can see what some of the adverse effects are. Physical destruction or damage. Well, we damaged that. Relocation of property. We moved things around as we were digging up the mine waste contaminants and we encountered that type of debris, we moved it. Change in the character of the property setting. Well, what was at one time viewed by many as being a very romantic, fun place to go to get some insight into your past, lost any and all feeling associated with that character as a result of our cleanup. And the like, neglect and deterioration is something that you would arguably find associated with other land management agencies, such as those found in agriculture or interior. But this gives you a sense as to the broad effect, the broad definition of adverse effect. Next slide, please, labeled determining area of potential effect and scope of effort. This is extraordinarily important, the concept of area of potential effect. This is the area within which a professional archaeologist will come in and perform some site of a type of a survey. So if you'll think of the larger area, the larger circle, that might be your entire site. The ape is the area within which the survey will occur. If you do not put those sideboards out there, then arguably the archaeologists, when they show up on site, will have unfettered access to all areas on your site, and that may not be something that you want. As I mentioned earlier, you're likely dealing with people who have little or no familiarity with CERCLA as a statute, and you're going to have to devote a considerable amount of time to helping them understand what it is, what it affords you as an OSC or as an RPM. And this includes not only scoping out your efforts, but also reading and understanding and interpreting the subsequent deliverables that you can anticipate receiving. Ideally, you should consult with the SHPO in determining the ape. But once again, the orientation of SHPOs has always been very expansive. It's just the nature of whom they are and what they do. And I have felt that is in large part attributable to the limitations that are otherwise imposed on their activities. And by that I mean if there are funds available to learn something about a site, they're going to push that as hard as they can and as far as they can, which may or may not be consistent with your scope, your schedule, your project ceilings, and the like. And there is also a requirement as part of this assessment of your site to engage Indian tribes should they have a role. And oftentimes SHPO can be the surrogate for providing that type of assistance, or most if not all regions have tribal coordinators. That would be another good place to go to see what, if any, federal tribes may be potentially implicated by your actions and how you might go about engaging them. Okay, the next slide is just a title slide, and it's circular removal and NHPA Section 106 processes. So if you'll go beyond that, please, to the overview. Now, as I suspect you can well imagine, there are two paths that can be pursued with respect to your 106 activities. The beginning of both is at the discovery or notification of a site. Now, the first path is emergency response. And similar to the 107, there is a programmatic agreement on protection of historic properties during emergency response under the NCP. And typically, this is included as an annex in all of the various nationwide area contingency plans. And in this programmatic agreement, you will find what is generally accepted as a definition of an emergency, which is an emergency shall be deemed to exist whenever circumstances dictate that a response action to a release or a spill must be taken so expeditiously that normal consideration of the Section 106 process is not reasonably practicable. And it's important to note that, again, it's both for CERCLA hazardous substances as well as spills, and it follows very closely the language that you would find in the NCP under 300.415, wherein this whole notion of determining whether compliance with ARARs is practicable, the OSC considers the exigencies of the circumstances, which includes urgency and scope. So it's pretty good to have that programmatic agreement in place. And then the other pathway is to just have a time-critical or a non-time-critical action, which if that's your case, then you fall more in line with what is the typical 106 process that includes evaluation and planning, implementation and documentation, and we're going to talk about all of those steps in greater detail here in a few moments. If you proceed to the next slide, please. NHPA Section 106 Programmatic Agreement on Historic Properties and Emergency Response. Again, what the programmatic agreement does is that it provides an alternative, but more importantly, it expressly states that neither 106 or the programmatic agreement itself are intended to interfere with an emergency response. Rather, it simply requires that those issues be considered. All right, next slide, please. Programmatic agreement flow chart. So this is the emergency response. So you first of all, you get a phone call. Now, unless the area contingency plan is very well fleshed out with respect to potential historical issues, or you have the personal knowledge of a particular site that might be impacted by a release or a discharge, you're going to have to go through a notification process that includes getting in contact with your SHPO or other designated entity so that you can gain some insight as to whether or not your site might fall within the context of 106. Now, the exception to that is that if your site falls into what's referred to as a categorical exclusion, and the list of those types of releases or spills that are categorically excluded is found in the programmatic agreement, and that includes such things as releases or spills to gravel pads, roads, parking areas, drill-in mats, airport runways, and the like. It also includes releases or spills that stay within defined areas, such as lined pits, water bodies, in some instances, containment areas and the like. So if you meet one of those areas that are categorically excluded from 106 compliance, then you're good to go. You need not do anything more other than document your determination and get it into the site file. On the other hand, if you find yourself not unable to avail yourself of one of those exclusions, then through consultation with SHPO and perhaps others, such as tribal entities, you're tasked to make reasonable and timely efforts to notify and consult with appropriate parties. In other words, now that you have knowledge of a situation, you're reaching out and you're making contact. Based on that contact then and the type of guidance that you receive, there will be recommendations that are presented by who knows whom as to how you could otherwise avoid or reduce, you know, adversely affecting historic properties to the extent practicable considering the exigencies of the situation. And it's a good thing. And of course, after you've had that conversation, you are going to want to document and the like. But once again, this process is not meant to impede or otherwise interfere with your cleanup activities. It simply represents a reasonable effort to reach out to the appropriate parties with some regulatory involvement to engage them, to solicit ideas from them, and to look for ways to minimize your adverse effects. So an example might be, let's say, for example, you were in Oregon and you were near the confluence of the Willamette River with the Columbia River out in the Portland Harbor area. And there were the remnants of an old wharf or a pier system or something such as that. That was very, very old. And as luck would have it, there would be the significance associated with it that we had discussed earlier, and people are going to be asking that those particular features be preserved in as much as you can. And you're responding to a discharge of oil in some manner, and the oil is, let's say, it's smearing on the side of the piers or something like that. Well, one approach might be to simply remove the structures in their entirety. Another approach might be to come in and steam clean, but in doing so, you might affect the aesthetic sensibilities of the feature, or you might come in and by hand remove the oil or otherwise place booms around them and the like. So, you know, by talking with other agencies, they may say, you know, do it by hand or place booms so as to preserve the character of the piers or the wharf in as much as you can. And that would seem to be a very reasonable proposal that an OSC might be able to take and to follow. But more importantly, whatever the outcome of that emergency consultation process is, it's memorialized, and within the programmatic agreement, there are steps that are listed as to how you would go about memorializing whatever your ultimate cleanup approach is. Okay, could we move on to the next slide, please, labeled NHPA Section 106 Consultation Process. Okay, this is the more formal process, and the intent behind this is to gather information, to reach out and see if those types of features that were discussed are found on your site, or your site in some manner appeals to those features. You know, how might determine how those historic properties might be affected, explore measures to avoid or reduce adverse effects, and address adverse effects to the extent practicable considering the exigencies of the situation. Now, where you would go to find a discussion as to what the requirements might be in your state, again, you would want to look at whomever your state historic preservation officer is. And that person, whether or not they're in a department labeled historic preservation, I don't know. again, Washington. It's the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation. And you will find, I suspect, in some instances, that the steps that we're about to talk about on the next page are slightly different than what I've lined out. Okay, can we move on to the next slide labeled Section 106 flowchart? Generally speaking, the first step is the same. And how you go about initiating that is the agency, and whomever the agency is, has got to make the determination as to whether or not there is an undertaking. And please recall that the definition of an undertaking is very expansive. It includes a project or an activity, a program funded in whole or in part, including those types of activities that may be carried out on behalf of a federal agency. So, first step is there an undertaking? If there isn't, and there's no potential, where there's no potential to cause effects of any sort, then you have no further action. You simply document it, and you're out of there. On the other hand, if you think that there might be historic properties found on your site, at that point you would get in touch with your SHPO and you would further initiate the process. Get a determination as to whether or not there were any historic properties affected. If SHPO comes back and says no, you're doing pretty good. On the other hand, if they say there might be, well, it's at this point in step three that you would have to engage a professional consultant to come in and inventory all historic and archaeological resources within the APE or the area of potential effect, which are over 50 years old. And then as a result of that evaluation, you will, in all likelihood, receive a listing of certain properties that are eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places or not. Hopefully it's the latter. If you do find properties that are listed at that point, then you should enter, or the regulations will state or encourage you to enter into an MOU with SHPO, and you reach some sort of an agreement as to how you're going to go about to address the adverse effects associated with your project, with SHPO's oversight and involvement vis-a-vis the memorandum of agreement or the memorandum of understanding. I suspect it would be an MOA, but again, each state may have its own approach to this. And it's that last step is that's problematic. And if we can go to the next slide, please, which is case study Josephine Mill number one. And this is just a very short case study of a cleanup action that occurred at a site a number of years ago, wherein over a lengthy period of time, EPA Region 10 had numerous opportunities to go back and forth with the state of Washington SHPO, state of Washington Deputy Attorney General, all the way up to the Advisory Council on Historical Preservation, wherein we argued that we met the requirements of 106, and of course the state said we didn't. So if we can go to the next slide labeled background. This just simply gives you some insight into the site. The first image on the preceding slide shows the mine and mill as it existed decades ago. It was up in northeast Washington, 5.3 acres in size. A number of activities and waste were left on place. The mill closed down in the mid-1930s and had been generally abandoned ever since that. Next slide, please. So when we showed up a number of years ago, that's what we saw. Recall you saw a structure advancing up the hill, very typical of a gravity-fed mill wherein the raw product, if you will, was dumped in at the top of the mill and then processed subsequently down gradient or taking advantage of gravity. So that's the old footprint of the mill that you see. The gray area in the center are tailings. All that you see on the bottom are tailings as well. Next slide, please. Just beneath the mill are a number of tailings impoundments that had blown out over time. And what you see there is just the woody debris that was left on site, incidental to the gradual demolition and destruction of the mill building. Next slide, please. That's just another example of a large tailings impoundment. And the wood that you see on the slope is simply wood and timbers that were used to shore up the impoundment. Next slide, please. That's just another image of some of the historical wooden structures that you encountered were you to walk up the hillside. There you see an old wooden table crib structure and more debris scattered throughout the ground surface. By the way, because this site did not have unrestricted access, you had an abundance of more contemporary waste, evidence of surreptitious disposal, people would just pull off the road, go back there and throw away their trash. Next slide, please, labeled collapsed wooden building. What that shows, again, is the character of the wood that you found. It was planks of wood, well-weathered. All of that wood was impregnated with the contaminants of concern, which were heavy metals. And then you can see tailings further moving towards the stream and the like. And every now and then, just off of center, you see what appears to be some metal. What that is that's the old truck body that you saw a couple of slides prior. And I think the next slide you see that's unlabeled is just a redundant slide showing the wooden cribbage and whatnot that was going up slope there. So that's what we encountered. Next slide, chronology of events. This was a non-time critical removal action that was being performed by a potentially responsible party with EPA oversight. So the first step in that process is to issue an approval memorandum for the conduct of an engineering evaluation cost analysis. We did that in December of 2009. In January of 2010, we had an archaeologist go out on site and perform the cultural resources survey. The ECA was issued in March of 2010, the action memorandum in September of 2010, and then from September through November, we went out and we provided oversight of the PRP's performance of the cleanup. Recall now that the cultural resources survey was completed early in 2010. Next page. Please, slide labeled Protection of Historic Properties. Okay, and this is when the fun began. From August 2010 through June of 2011, there was a seemingly endless back and forth between the agency and the state of Washington. So the complete process that we went through is we determined that our action was an undertaking. We submitted a letter to SHPO for the project by defining on a map the area of potential effects. We hired a professional consultant, or the PRP did. We determined its eligibility, and we also determined that there would be no effect. The SHPO did not concur, and at the end of the day, we made the final determination with assistance from the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. But you'll see, though, that beginning in August, that's when it started. We made a finding. We sent it off and the Washington SHPO disagreed. Heaven once disagreed. We went back and forth, exchanged multiple correspondence and conference calls with all parties between EPA, the state, and the ACHP to involve our interpretation of the National Historic Preservation Act in the context of CERCLA. One of the more contentious issues associated with this was that the SHPO had little, if any, familiarity with CERCLA as a process, did not understand nor appreciate EPA's ability to work within that context, and how EPA went about managing sites with respect to ARARs, and that is we did not have to burden the project with the administrative requirements that are otherwise associated for those sites that didn't have the benefit of ARARs. The SHPO also wanted to enter into a memorandum of agreement, which we said absolutely no on. And this just went back and forth and back and forth and ratcheted its way up. All the while, please keep in mind that as this was unfolding, we had already completed the cleanup. The action itself was completed in 11-10, and the dispute between the parties went on until June of 2011. I've had similar sites elsewhere in the inland Northwest where I initiated the 106 process because it was a decision to be made by EPA as to whether it was an undertaking or not. I made those determinations and I submitted. There was some very preliminary back and forth with the SHPO, but at the end of the day, I shipped in the report, which is frankly a very well-written report of the rail lines embedded in concrete and the like. And, you know, the long and short of it was that SHPO said, why are you even bothering to tell us what you've done, given the fact that you've already done it? And I had to go to great lengths to explain to them how the process worked. And at the end of it, they were appreciative and said thank you, and that was that. So let's go to the next slide, please, summary. There's a couple of walkaways that are associated with this. And that is the National Historic Preservation Act is an ARAR. And we have to take that into account to the maximum extent practicable, considering the exigencies of the situation. And while this could exempt EPA from having to comply with this during an emergency, there is a programmatic agreement out there that most parties are familiar with, certainly EPA and the Coast Guard, other land management agencies and the like. Whether or not the respective SHPOs have that much familiarity with it, I'm not sure. It's not an onerous process, and frankly, it doesn't matter whether they're familiar with it or not. EPA is a signatory to the agreement, and we've committed to following it. Eligibility for the National Register of Historic Properties is the purview of the Advisory Council on Historic Properties and SHPO. And frankly, it's EPA is best off to respect that authority, although EPA has the final say-so. And these entities have a problem with accepting that because that's not routine for them. And we have to be mindful of that, particularly when we're talking about tribes. So those are the walkaways. There's provisions for emergency responses. It's not that complicated to have to deal with 106 requirements as part of the normal process. You should expect having to explain to people not only your consultant or your PRP's consultant who comes on site, but also to others, the context that you're working within. If it's CERCLA, if it's not CERCLA and oil, you've got to comply with both the administrative and the procedural requirements of the Act. And you should always be very mindful of the parties that you're working with. All right, next slide, please. And that slide is questions. So are there any questions, Jean?
Okay, again, we do have some time here at the end of the webinar to go through questions. So if you'd like, you can submit them electronically into the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. We do have some that were submitted already, so I will start with those and see if we get any additional submitted during our time here. So the first question asks, how does a natural resource damage assessment fit with ESA and NHPA with these consultations?
Okay, good question. And the natural resource damage process is not part of the National Historic Preservation Act process. So there's no relationship whatsoever. On the other hand, it is an activity that is associated with the Endangered Species Act, and where it would come into play is that the agencies or the services, if you will, while on one hand EPA or other federal agencies with the delegated authority for a CERCLA response are in the throes of cleaning up the effects of the release, other agencies such as Fish and Wildlife or National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration personnel will come in and on a parallel path then begin to assess the extent of either the release or the discharge on the natural resources. But even though they're related, they're two completely different activities with different funding streams and the like.
Okay. The next question gets into funding. This attendee wants to know, why are funds from CERCLA used in association with 106 compliance if the site is not affected by hazardous waste?
Well, they wouldn't be. So, for example, in order to trigger a removal action, you've got to meet certain thresholds. One is you've got to have, pursuant to the statute 104, section 104, you need to have either a hazardous substance or a pollutant or a contaminant. Then you have to make, pursuant to 415B1, a determination of threat, 415B2, you've got to evaluate that threat against the 8 removal factors. And then if you trigger one of those factors, you've got to consider 415E, the range of potential removal actions. So the only time that CERCLA would come into play with respect to compliance with the National Historic Preservation Act, with respect to cleanups, is first of all whether you had a cleanup. Now, recall that that is but one type of activity. Other activities might be, in looking for that federal nexus, as if EPA were to fund an entity to some lesser or greater extent to go out and to do certain things that potentially have an impact on historic places. And then there would be the requirement for that receiving entity of the grant to comply with 106. But the only way that CERCLA would come in is if you had hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants that met the other criteria, and then for your site to have, you know, the either actual historical sites or potential historical sites, and then you would have to comply with those 106 requirements vis-a-vis ARARs. Clear as mud? The other thing where ESA might come in, but again, it wouldn't be related to NHPA, but if your site happened to have some, you know, listed historic properties and some that were eligible, and it just happened to be on the Columbia River, let's say, or some other river where you've got a listed species, steelhead, salmon, bull trout, or something like that, then the ESA would come into play as another ARAR. And there might be some issues, particularly if incidental to your cleanup you had to remove pilings or sunken vessels, and that would have to be weighed against, you know, habitat issues, migratory behavior, times of year of T&E species and the like. So the OSC or the RPM would have to figure that out.
Okay. We did have a question that asks, what is our obligation to find out whether there might be any archaeological remains prior to a removal where there are no obvious historical structures at the surface?
That's an interesting question, and clearly there's been many sites that I've had in the past where I've made that determination. And I would simply characterize it as due diligence. You do your due diligence with respect to a site. Does your site fall into one of those categorical exclusions where it's done for you? Or is your familiarity with the site such that you can come to a reasonable conclusion that there are no listed or potential sites? And if you can do that, fine. Document your decision in whatever form it takes. Maybe you're going to have your start contractor do something. Maybe you have a civil investigator who's involved with a 104E search of some sorts, and he or she are gathering information for you. On the other hand, if you're uncertain, it would be very, very easy to get in contact with people whom you should already have a relationship and ask for their opinion. Ask for them to make, call your tribal representative, let's say, and ask they reach out to the tribe and see if there's any issues there. So there's many ways to come at this before you actually trigger that process, and I've done many of them myself.
Okay. We also had a question that came in earlier, and this one asks, how can you recommend that we find a contact at the U.S. FWS?
Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes.
Great question. What I would recommend, other than Googling for the answer, you could go in fws.gov, and that'll give you access to their main web page. And through there, you can search. And keep in mind that, there's different supervisors' offices that are out in different places of the country and the like. You could also, the OSCs run the spill line, and there should be a notification call down list, and there should be a contact either in Interior, the Department of Interior, or maybe in the Department of Commerce that you can call, who's a point of contact for those types of agencies, and ask them who would be the appropriate person and the agency to get in contact with, and ask for their number.
Okay, excellent. I don't see any additional questions in the queue, so I'd like to turn back to you for a moment, Earl, and see if there are any closing thoughts you'd like to leave with the audience before we end things today.
Well, yes, and thank you for this opportunity. I have always found working in the West that there are certain statutes that you have to have at least just a passing familiarity with. And two of those statutes are the Endangered Species Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. It need not be onerous. There are well-established policies and procedures that are in place that the agency has followed. In fact, EPA has some guidance documents. For example, one is the Cultural Resources Management for U.S. EPA Personnel. It's dated July of 2013. And this in particular is for Section 106. But there are, these select statutes that are out there that are very easy to comply with. The flip side is that if you don't and you realize it too late in the game, it could adversely affect your schedule, your scope of cleanup activities, your project ceiling, and any number of other things. So it behooves everyone to at least have, a working knowledge of certain statutes, and these are two. And again, I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to have spent some time with each and every one of you today sharing some information on these two statutes.
All right, excellent. Thank you so very much, Earl. I'm going to walk through just a few final reminders before we close out today. I want to echo the audience's thanks, though, to you, Earl. A number of people wrote in with some very positive comments about your webinar today. I believe there was one person who wrote a message in here, roughly to the effect that, Earl, you know you are a pearl in anything that you do, so I want to be sure to pass that along.
Well,
to
I'm
you.
Not going to hesitate to speculate. It's better than the squirrel and some other things I've been referred to as.
But with that, I just wanted to remind everyone that copies of the presentation materials are currently available on the seminar links or resources page. So you can follow the links that appear on the middle right of the screen under related URLs. You can scroll through that list, click on the link of interest, and then press the Browse To button to open up the website locally on your own computer. You'll find information on our instructor and me as well, your organizer, on that seminar homepage as well. And there's also a link to fill out our online feedback form to help provide feedback both in the content that was covered but also the delivery mechanism. And one thing I want to point out, if you fill out that feedback form, you can download or print out a participation certificate. That's usually one of the biggest requests that we get from our participants and is how they can verify or document their attendance in our webinars. So again, I'll encourage you to fill out the online feedback form in today's webinar. Make sure you check the box that appears near the bottom of the form on the feedback form that basically says you certify that you attended the entire session. And once you submit that feedback form, you'll be able to download or print out a PDF copy of the participation certificate. If you happen to share the line with multiple people at your location, I encourage each person to fill out that feedback form so they can get their own copy of the